So first of all, thank you, Nalu, for the kind words. Maria, thank you for the incredible work, which I understand you have done with the secretary and help. And thank you all for showing up. Let's see. I would like to try to explain some of the main ideas in the subject. What I've done is to prepare a whole lot of slides. If integral calculus had not been invented, one would get the idea from these slides. There are very many of them, each one containing a negligible amount of information. The goal is to state most of the main theorems, not all of them, but most of them, and to give many of the main ideas, but unfortunately to give full details of almost nothing. So let's see, what will be the value of that exercise? We'll see. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it. I thought I would start with an overview and just state the theorems with no or almost no attempt to explain how anything is proven. Let's see. Okay. And of course, the following lectures. Okay. So the lectures discuss two closely related problems: interpolation and extension. Notice I gave a little bit. Okay. Okay. So here's the problem with interpolation. So we're given a real valued function. Let's say maybe later it will be vector value, but right now the real valued function defined at finitely many points of Rn. And the goal is to extend this function a little f to a function capital F defined on the whole Rn to make capital F more or less as smooth as possible. Okay, that was the problem of interpolation. The problem of extension is almost the same, but with a different flavor and involving different ideas. The set E on which the initial function f is defined is this set E is not necessarily finite. In the interesting cases, it's infinite. And then the problem is to decide simply whether there exists a smooth function, capital F, defined on the whole Rn that agrees with the given function little f. So interpolation and extension. Okay. So in the first lecture, I'm going to state theorems, and the other nine lectures will discuss the proofs and indicate some further results. So I say discuss the proofs. I'm not actually going to give the complete, but again, I hope to present some of the main ideas in the proofs of most of the results. Okay, so let's get started. Okay, so let's fix the notation. All right, so X is going to be our favorite Banach space of continuous functions on Rn. In these talks, X is either going to be Cm of Rn or Cm alpha. In other words, the nth derivatives are Hilbert of order alpha. Or maybe WMP, so the functions and their distribution derivatives up to order m belong to LP. So those are the spaces in which we will work, the spaces in which we will measure smoothness. Now, there are going to be an awful lot of constants. Oh, by the way, I should have said, you shouldn't bother taking notes. These slides are going to be put on the web. Okay. Any constant denoted by the letter C, uppercase, lowercase, with a prime, a star, whatever, all these constants are supposed to depend only on the choice of the space we use to measure smoothness, and not on the particular problem we're solving. Okay, so for example, if X is WMP of Rn, then any constant denoted by the letter C will depend only on M and P. Okay, all right, so more notation. Suppose that E is a finite subset of Rn. X and E is going to be the space of all functions little f from E to R, with the norm that you see on the slide. The idea is that we want to extend little f to a function capital F in our function space X, and we would like to make that norm as small as possible, and the inf of that norm is what we call the norm of little f in the space X of E. Later on, E will be infinite, and then X of E will not consist of all functions, but rather only of those functions that have extensions. But of course, if it's finite and X is one of the spaces we talked about, then any function has at least some extensions. Okay. Notice I said inf, I didn't say minimum. In elementary examples, there is no minimum, there's only an inf. This gives rise to the idea of an A optimal extension. So A is a constant. Notice it's not denoted by the letter C. A is some constant, little f is a function on E, capital F is a function on X, and capital F is an A optimal extension of little f if it agrees with little f on E, and its norm in the space X differs from the inf of all possible such norms by at most a factor of A, as on the slide. Okay? Please stop me if anything isn't perfectly clear. I feel a little strange giving introductory lectures to an audience that includes experts explaining to various people theorems that they themselves have proven. So bear with me. Okay, I do want to make this completely self-contained. Okay, so what are the problems? Here's the rough statement of the problems. So we're given such a function space X, we're given a finite set E, we're given a function little f, as before. There are two main problems in this setting. One is to compute the order of magnitude of the norm of little f in X of E, and the other is to compute the C optimal extension of F. So now C is not A, it's C, so C is supposed to depend only on which space it used to measure norms. These problems seem reasonable, but of course they're not well defined. I have to explain what it means to compute the order of magnitude of a number, and I have to explain what it means to compute a function. I had in mind using a computer, so these are algorithms to be executed on some idealized computer. I'm not going to spend valuable time by giving a careful discussion of exactly what a computer is, but just imagine it's what sits on your desk. So to compute the order of magnitude of some quantity, like the norm of f, means to compute not that quantity itself, but some other quantity which is guaranteed to differ from the thing you really want to compute by at most a constant factor c. So that's what it means to compute the order of magnitude. Okay, now computing a function with a computer is a more delicate thing because, of course, a computer is somehow inherently a finite object and a function is inherently an infinite object. So here's what I mean. So we enter the data into our computer and the computer displays on the screen, okay, I've understood the data, thank you, please wait. The computer then performs one-time work, after which it displays on the screen, thank you for your patience, I have now computed the extension capital F, and I welcome your queries. We may then query the computer. To query the computer, we enter the coordinates of a point in Rn, and in response to our query, x, the computer calculates the value of the function capital F. And if our function is, let's say, cn, it will also, for good measure, compute the derivatives of the function at the given point up to order n, beyond which we have no right to ask because our function is merely cn. Okay. So that's what it means to compute a function. That's a very demanding notion. So, for example, if you want to solve some elementary ODE, you probably cannot compute it this way because the best you can do is to do a very, very good job of giving a very close approximation. Here we're asked to compute it exactly and find out how many computer operations. So this idea of computing a function can be criticized easily, but the criticism is that the notion is too restrictive, and so when we succeed in computing a function this way, we're in good shape. Okay. A little detail, the response to a query should depend only on the data and the point at which you ask the query. There are tricky algorithms in which one saves up information from previous queries to use in the query at the moment. Those are called, I think, adaptive algorithms, and I don't allow those. Okay, now I'm interested in efficient algorithms. So that means that they make minimal use of the computer resources involved in computation. What are the computer resources in the computation? Well, for computing a function, here are the relevant resources. They are the number of operations for the one-time work, and operations, let's say, multiplying two numbers together, or saving a number to memory, or fetching a number from memory, or something like that. So the number of operations of one-time work, the number of operations to answer a query, and the size of the random access memory, the RAM. Let's say that the memory is fixed so that one memory cell and the RAM can hold one real number, and let's not worry about Randolph errors, although if you look at the papers in the literature, you'll find that we've actually worried about Randolph errors. Now, these are three different computer resources, so it would be natural to expect trade-offs. For instance, it would be natural to hope that that we do more one-time work in order to save on the query work, because presumably we'll do the one-time work once and we'll answer a lot of queries. But in fact, an algorithm that I'll sketch for you later will optimize all three of these, so it'll be very efficient in three different senses. Here are lower bounds for the work. If we're interpolating a function from n points, we had better at least read the data, so that's one-time work at least n. In order to answer a query, we should at least print out an answer, even if we don't bother to read the query. So that's work at least one. And the memory used had better be at least n, because we had better at least save the data. Okay, and we'll come within logarithmic factors of those trivial lower bounds. Okay, so those are the resources involved in computing a function. In computing the order of magnitude of the norm, we're just computing one number, and so the relevant computer resources are simply the number of operations needed and the size of the RAM, and we'll optimize both. And the trivial lower bounds are that for the computation of the order of magnitude, if there are n points, and capital N always denotes the number of points, the number of operations needed is at least n because we better read the data, and the size of the memory is at least n because we better hold the data. Okay. Now, the fundamental point is that we're interested in algorithms that always work for any finite set. So if we allow ourselves favorable geometric assumptions on E, our task would be much easier. Okay. And so I'd like to show you a few delicate cases to see what can go wrong. So here's the first delicate case. I'm not telling you the function to be interpolated. I'm just telling you the set X, the Banach space X, it's going to be C5 of R2. And I'm going to tell you the set B. And the set B is simply all the red dots of the plane. Notice that all of the red dots lie very close to the x1 axis, except for the point labeled x. So now suppose that I ask you, what is the x2 derivative of the function capital F, the interpolant, at the point z? Now, basically, no information about that is coming from any of the red dots other than x. But if we take the red dots x and y, then we can use them to find a difference quotient that approximates the partial of f in some direction transverse to the x1 axis at y. And if z is close to y, we get information that way. Okay. But it may happen that there are 10,000 points lying between y and z, and therefore any algorithm that tries to understand what's going on at z by looking at the 10,000 closest points to z will inevitably fail. So that's bad. So if that happens, we better recognize it and respond to it quickly. Example 2 is completely analogous, except that instead of all but one or two of the dots lying close to the x-axis, one or two of the dots lie close to the zero set of some polynomial whose degree is less than the degree of smoothness defined in the space x. That's basically the same phenomenon. Except that nobody, if this arises, nobody is going to give you this curve. You just see a collection of red dots. And so you would better realize quickly that there is a curve, and you'd better respond to it quickly. And that's still not the full difficulty. The full difficulty is indicated by example 3, in which the space X is C5 of R3, and we lie very, very close to some algebraic surface, sigma. There's a fancy for drawing it now. Surface, and furthermore, it lies somewhat close, not as close as to sigma, but still rather close to an algebraic curve sitting on that surface. And one had better detect all of that geometry simply from the red dots themselves and respond accordingly. Okay, so there's the moral I just said. There it's written. Okay, so real algebraic geometry is going to enter the story. What are the results for CM of R? So this is joint work with Boaz Bartok. So here X is CM of RM. I'll define the norm more carefully, but let's just believe that we know what the norm is. E is our finite set. It has capital F points. Little f is a real value function. That's the setup described before. And the story is that one can compute a C optimal extension using at most C n log n operations of one-time work, C log n operations to answer the query, C n memory cells of RAM. And so if you remember the trivial lower bounds, those are within logarithmic factors of the trivial lower bounds, and very likely optimal. What we have there are optimal, is optimal. Okay. Furthermore, one can compute the order of magnitude of the norm using at most C n log n operations and C n memory cells of RAM. We'll see how in later lectures. Okay. And again, that's all right. So the upper bounds of the required work in memory are the log factor of the trivial lower bounds, and very likely the upper bounds are sharp. Okay. These are practical problems. However, damn it, the algorithms aren't at all practical because some of the constants are too big. And so one of the things that I would love to be able to do is to make all of those constants reasonable size, in which case this goes from having absolutely no practical applications to possibly having a lot of practical applications. Okay. Now, these algorithms are based on math. In particular, they're closely related to Whitney's extension problem, which I'm not mentioning. Okay. So Whitney's question, let's say for CM, is let's fix m and n greater than or equal to 1. Let e be a subset of rm. Now let's say it's an infinite subset. And let phi be a function defined by e. How can we decide by looking at phi and e whether phi extends to a function in cm of rm? Okay. If such a function f exists, there are natural questions. For example, how small can we take its cm norm? Can we take capital F to depend linearly on the data phi? And what can we say about the derivatives of f, let's say, at or near a point of e? Okay. Now, I want to mention three big ideas regarding Whitney's extension problem. The first is the Whitney extension theorem, which is that if we fix our m and n, and we're given e, now let's say e is compact. That's not a serious loss of generality. So e is a compact set. And for each point x and e, we are given an m3p polynomial, which we hope will be the Taylor polynomial of our function capital F. And then the question is, does there exist a capital F in Cm whose nth degree Taylor polynomial at each point of the set e is the given px, as in the slide? Okay. That was Whitney's question, modifying the original question in which you're given merely function values and not Taylor polynomials. And Whitney discovered that the obvious necessary conditions that arise from Taylor's theorem, which we'll meet soon enough, are sufficient. So there are obviously necessary conditions which are in fact sufficient. That's Whitney's extension theorem. Okay, and so in fact, the main point of the second lecture, which will happen after the break, is that I'll give a sketch, the main ideas of the proof of the classical Whitney extension theorem. Okay. That was the first big idea regarding Whitney's problem. The second big idea is the idea of Glaser refinements. Glaser was a French mathematician who, in the late 50s, solved Whitney's extension problem in the special case of C1 of Rn using a geometric construction which he called the iterated paratangent model. That idea was further developed by Ed Bierstone, Pierre Milman, and Wiesław Pawlowski for Cm of Rn. For subanalytic subsets of Rn. And we'll see that by carrying those ideas still further, one can give a full solution to Whitney's original problem in the general case. So I'll state the relevant results later in this talk and one of the future, two of the future lectures, I think, will be devoted to sketching that in more detail and discussing the proof. Okay. The third big idea in connection with Whitney's extension problems is the idea of finiteness principles discovered and explored over a long time by Yuri Grudnin and Paul Schwarzman. In particular, the connection of the algorithms for CM interpolation that I talked about before to Whitney's extension problem arises precisely from the finiteness principle. Okay, so what's a finiteness principle? So here's the theorem of Grudnin-Schwarzman, the Grudnin cookie charts of the finiteness principle. Given m and n greater than or equal to 1, there exist constants of integer constant k and a real constant c, determined only by m and n, such that the following holds. Okay, so suppose we're looking at an interpolation problem. We have a little f mapping e to r. E is a finite subset of Rn as usual. Suppose that whenever S is a k-point subset of E, if we restrict F to S and measure the norm of it in Cm of S, that is the interval of the norms of all possible extensions, that's less than or equal to 1. Then for the whole extension problem, the norm is less than or equal to C. So in other words, to know the least attainable norm for any extension problem on any big finite set, no matter how big, it's enough to examine all possible k-point subsets. That's the theorem in general. Now, this theorem and several related results were conjectured by Urey and Pavlov in the 80s, along with several related results proven much later. Pavlov proved the analogous theorem with Cm replaced by C1 alpha. In particular, C11 is equivalent to C2 by very simple reasoning that you'll see. So up to degree of smoothness 2, Pavlov solved the problem. And Pavlov's proof for C1 alpha was based on a wonderful idea of Lipschitz selection, which we're going to meet again in the last lecture, and by the way, in Pavlov's talk tomorrow. Right tomorrow? Yes? Yes. Okay. And the original proof gives an optimal value for the so-called finiteness constant k, that is the size of the subproblems you have to consider. It's given by this curious formula, 3 times 2 to the power n minus 1. That suggests that there's no trivial proof of the theorem because trivial arguments are unlikely to lead to k that big. Okay. Urey and Pavlov also proved a version of the finiteness theorem for C1 of omega, omega any modulus of continuity, again with the absolutely sharp value of k. That value of k is the best possible. There are counterexamples to back that up. But to treat Cm for m greater than 2, we need to do something completely different, at least as far as anyone knows today. And so the Lipschitz selection and the completely different will link up near the end of the series. Okay, now I'd like to talk about a refined finiteness theorem for Cm of Rn. This is joint work of Boas and me. If you think about the finiteness theorem, let's say for C2 of R2, so that k is 6, if you want to solve an interpolation problem, it's enough to look at every 6-point subset. But damn it, there are an awful lot of those. If there are n points in the set E, there are about n to the 6 point subsets. That's too big. We're going to do a lot better. And so here's the theorem. So suppose that, again, we fix m and n, the usual. Then there exists constants c and k depending on the interval m, such that the following holds. Okay, suppose that E is a finite subset of Rn containing capital N points. Now, notice I haven't given you a function little f yet. I've just given you Well, then there is a list of small subsets. The small subsets are called S1 through SL, and they have the following properties. First of all, L, the number of those subsets, grows only linearly with the number of points of E. So that's a big improvement over n to the sixth. Each of these subsets is small. That's the second point mentioned on the slide. Each of them is at most k points. And now we introduce functions f on the set E, and the claim is that for any f mapping E to R, the norm of f in Cm of E, that is the infinite of Cm norms of all extensions, is dominated by a constant times the maximum of the corresponding norms for the subproblems arising from the particular subsets S1 through SL. Well, that's nice, except how are we going to compute S1 through SL? But in fact, they can be computed efficiently from E, and I spare you the details because in a future lecture I will spare you fewer details. Okay, let me just give here the glimmer of the proof. So for the glimmer of the proof, let me give notation. So let's say Jx of f is the nth degree, or say m minus first degree Taylor polynomial of f about x, and it belongs to the vector space script p of all such nth degree or m minus first degree polynomials, j for jet. If we were on a manifold, instead of talking about the Taylor polynomial of a function, we'd talk about its jet. But we're on Rn, so the jet and the Taylor polynomial are the same thing, but the Taylor polynomial is denoted by j. Okay. So here's the right question to ask to lead us to the above results. Okay. Suppose that there is a function f at Cm of Rn, and its norm is at most capital N. And it agrees with the data. If there is such an interpolator, what can we say about its Taylor polynomial at a particular point x? Okay, so given an interpolation problem of a little f at b, and given a point x and a number m, let's define gamma of xm, as on the slide. It's the set of all Taylor polynomials at x, all functions capital F that do what we want. Namely, they lie in Cm of Rn. The norm in Cm of Rn is at most capital M, and they agree with F on E. So that's an interesting set. And asking what can we say about the Taylor polynomial amounts to say, compute this set. Notice that this set is obviously convex, but it's not obviously non-empty. It might be empty if we are greedy and we take M so small that there is no such interpolant that gamma will be empty. So this is a possibly empty convex set in script P, the space of all polynomials of the appropriate degree. Okay, now the real algebraic geometry that I talked about is actually encoded in the size and shape of the convex sets gamma. In particular, if E is close to the set where P is zero, then gamma of Xm is long in the P direction, P being a polynomial. Indicates a direction in the vector space of polynomials, and the gamma will be long in that direction and not so long in other directions for which E does not lie so close to this set. And I'm just going to say that now, that there will be discussion to back that up in future lectures. Okay, so to prove the refined finiteness theorem with Boas, what we do is we first understand the approximate size and shape of those convex sets gamma. And then once we've computed the gammas, at least for the points of E, we will then use that information to compute an interpolant with control norm that agrees with the data on E. That's the plan. First understand the gamma, then use the gamma in order to build an interpolant. And let's see. And these convex sets gamma and their close relatives, sigma, to be introduced in a later lecture, will play a fundamental role in all the results discussed in these 10 lectures. Okay, so I think at least one full lecture will be devoted entirely to discussion of gammas and sigmas. Okay, here's a nice application. We're going to remove outliers. So suppose that we're given an interpolation problem. I would like to find a small subset of E such that if you remove that small subset, all of a sudden it becomes possible to interpolate with a much smaller norm. This is this arises all the time, let's say, in experimental science. I remember my own career as an undergraduate, a double major in math and physics, trying to do experiments producing only outliers and ungenerated points. Okay, so here's a simple one-dimensional example. The red points have been measured by Charlie, and the other points have been measured by others, and then one wants to interpolate, and it would be a good idea to remove the three outliers. And so the theorem we're going to prove is that the set can be enumerated, a first point, a second point, and so on through the last point n, in such a way that for any z less than or equal to n, if you look at the set of the first z points, and that's called Sz, it has the following property. If you take any competing set, which you'd like to remove instead of the set S sub z, it never happens that S is much better than Sz. In the following sense, it does not happen that S contains far fewer points than Z, and its norm is far smaller. So there's the statement on the slide. Furthermore, the enumeration can be computed in Cn squared log n computer operations. I was personally very surprised to discover this, but in contrast to the previous algorithms, I would say there's no reason to believe that this is optimal. There's a hint square there, and maybe this can be improved. Okay, and I'm going to skip this, the sketch of the algorithm. We'll actually explain the algorithm in more detail in a future lecture, but I'm worried about time. Okay, but just say that analogous results hold for CM alpha, CM functions whose nth derivatives are Lipschitz of order alpha in place of CM. Analogous results hold. Let me not bother with statement. Okay, now let's talk about Sobolev spaces. So this is a joint work with Arjen Israel and Kevin Lutley. Let me make a very important announcement for those who have been, for the experts who have been coming to these lectures in the past. The daughter of Joanne and Kevin Lutley was born on August 2nd and is in good health. Her name is Harian, which I'm told means, apparently means victory, happiness, and that means something like grace and kindness. Sobolev spaces. So there are two flavors. We're going to talk about inhomogeneous and homogeneous Sobolev spaces. So X might be WNV, the space of all functions which, together with their derivatives up to order M, belong to LP. Or that's the inhomogeneous flavor. In the homogeneous flavor, X might be LMP of Rn, the space of functions whose derivatives of order exactly N belong to LP. This space includes, for example, polynomials of degree less than n, and then those have semi-norm zero if they belong to the space. Okay. So there are two flavors. Okay. Now, there's a restriction on P. P had better be greater than n over m, and of course P is greater than or equal to 1. P is greater than or equal to 1 so that we have a Baumol space, and P is greater than n over m so that the Sobolev theorem guarantees that functions in X are at least continuous, so that we can talk about their values on a finite set. Here we're going to make a stronger assumption that P is greater than N. That guarantees that that our spaces are contained in C M minus 1. The derivatives of order up to M minus 1 are continuous. Okay. For any subset E, not necessarily finite, X and E is the space of all restrictions to E of functions in X. And the norm or semi-norm is given as on the slide. It's the inf of the norms of all possible extensions. And of course, there are some possible extensions because that's what it means for a little left of a one-way space. Notice that if E is finite, X of E consists of all real-valued functions, but we still have to understand that norm or semi-norm. I would be lazy and always say norm, even though it's half the time semi-norm. Okay. And recall, constants denoted by the letter C depend only on the choice of X. And so, since we're looking at Sobolev spaces, that means that constants denoted by the letter C depend only on little m of P. Okay, so the first theorem is that there are linear extension operators. So for any arbitrary subset of Rn, there's a linear map T from X of E to X with the properties on the slide, namely TF agrees with F on E, and TF belongs to X, and its norm in X is less than the constant times the norm of F and X of E. So there is such an operator. Well, for the completely general set E, there's no information on what T looks like. That's a shame. This ought to be improved. But if E is finite, there's a lot of information about how the operator looks. In particular, such a linear extension operator may be computed efficiently. And I don't have time to tell you what that means now, but we'll hear a lot about it in a future lecture. It can be computed. And by using it, we can just apply that linear extension operator to any particular function we like, little f. And therefore, we can compute the C optimal extension of any given little f using at most the order of n log n one-time work, log n query work, and Cn memory, as in the Cn case. So from this point of view, the study of the Sobolev spaces is almost as well developed as in the as for Cn. And there's also a formula for the norm. And here's the story. If E is finite, so E is a capital n point subset of Rn, then there's a list of linear functionals on the space X of E with the following properties. Okay? First of all, the number of these linear functionals, it grows only linearly in the size of the set E. Secondly, if we look at the little LP norm of the values of those linear functionals, that's on the slide, okay, the P through root of the sum of the Pth powers of all the linear functions applied to a particular F, that has the same order of magnitude as the norm. And so this quantity, triple norm of E, allows us to compute the order of magnitude of the norm of a function, little f. Moreover, these Cs have a sparse structure, which I will explain later, and it means that given a particular function f, we can compute all the linear functionals, and therefore the proximal norm, using O of N of capital N computer operations once the Cs are known. So if linear, to find this norm takes basically no more time than to read the data. However, that assumes that we know what the Xs are. But finally, the Xs can be computed efficiently using at most n log n operations and at most cn memory cells of RAM. Okay. Well, before I leave Sobolev spaces, let me just note that we've assumed that P is greater than n. Many, many years ago, in starting to address this question, at least my own attitude, maybe also that Ari and Kevin, was, well, all right, let's do that case, and then the other would be a simple pop-up. But boy, that's the opposite of the truth, and we don't know anything about P less than we do today. So that, I would say that's a very significant problem. Okay, let me switch gears. Let me talk about Cn of E when E is infinite. So that's back to Whitney's original question in 1934. So let's remember what that is. We're giving E, let's say, compact in Rn, and we're given a real value function of on E, and we're given a particular number of derivatives, little m, and we want to know whether there is a function capital F in Cn that agrees with phi on E. That's Whitney's classic problem. Okay. In order to solve Whitney's classic problem, we're first going to generalize it. So in order to do that, we need a little bit more notation. So now, remember, Jx of F is the nth degree Taylor polynomial of F at X, and script P is the vector space of all such. Now, there's a natural multiplication on these Taylor polynomials. It depends on the particular point X at which you're Taylor expanding, and there it is on the slide. And the point is that this multiplication dot sub X has the property that if you look at the Taylor polynomial of the product of two smooth functions, it is equal to the product of those Taylor polynomials using the multiplication dot sub x. So that's jet multiplication. That's the name for it if we run a manifold. Okay. And so R sub x is the vector space script P with that multiplication. It's the ring of m jets at x. Of course, as x varies, these rings are all isomorphic, but they're not identical. So all right, so now here's the generalization of Whitney's problem. Let me state it, and then let me explain why it's a generalization of Whitney's problem, and then let me discuss the solution. So we're given a compact subset of R. For each point of that compact subset, we're given a coset of an ideal, that is, H of X is equal to I of X translated by F of X in the vector space script P, where F of X is some polynomial, and I of X is an ideal in Rx. Notice Rx is a ring, but it's also a finite dimensional vector space, so this, for each individual X, this is not a very big thing. Okay, but I've given one such for each X in E. And the problem is to decide whether there exists a Cn function whose Taylor polynomial belongs to that subspace H of X for each X in E. So X and H of X is a particular type of affine subspace in script E, and we want to know whether there exists such an F. Let me introduce a little bit of jargon. The collection of all these affine spaces is called a bundle. H of X at a particular point X is called the fiber. The set E is called the base. We demand that the base be compact. This is, of course, stealing from the geometers. Never mind. Okay, and F will be called a section if its Taylor polynomial belongs to H of X. So that's the jargon. Okay, so, and if we have two bundles, one is called a subbundle of the other if they lie over the same base, but the fibers of one are contained in the fibers of the other. So these definitions are all obvious once you decide that you're thinking about collections of affine spaces H of X. Okay, so our generalized Quigley problem has the following rephrasing. It's the exact same content as before, just using the fancy words. How can we decide whether a given bundle has a section? Okay, that's the question. Now, what does that have to do with Whitney's original question? Well, here's an example which will boil down to Whitney's original question. So suppose that phi is some function that we're trying to understand. So E is a compact subset of Rn, phi is a real value function. For each x in E, let's pick a particular f of x and a particular I of x. F of x is going to be a constant polynomial whose value at every point is phi of x. And I of x is the ideal in R of x, in R sub x, consisting of all polynomials p that vanish at x. And one can easily check that that's an ideal. Okay? And then h of x is f of x plus I of x, which means that h of x actually consists of all polynomials that agree with phi at the single point x. Okay, now that's a bundle. And when, if we just go back and look at what the definitions mean, you see at once that a given function in Cn is a section of that bundle, if and only if it agrees with phi on E, by definition. Okay, so therefore phi extends to a function capital F if and only if this bundle, this particular bundle, has a section. Okay, so the classic Whitney problem is a special case of the generalized Whitney problem. Okay, so now let's solve the generalized Whitney problem, and in particular, that will solve the particular classical Whitney problem. Okay, it's convenient to make a small but very strange-looking change in the definition of a bundle. Namely, we're going to allow the empty set as a fiber at any given point. Okay, so now the correct definition of a bundle is that it's a collection of H of X, where E is compact, and for each X, either it's what it was before, the translated and ideal being Rx, or it's the empty set. That strange-looking change will pay for itself soon. Okay, so that's what a bundle is. Okay, now of course if H has any empty fibers, guess what, it has no sections. It's very difficult for the Taylor polynomial of a function at even point to go into the empty set. Okay. And now, here's the key idea. Following Glaser, and then Bristol, Norman, and Kropinski, we are going to define an operation on bundles called Glaser refinement. Okay, so given a bundle, we're going to produce another bundle, denoted with a tilde. That's the Glaser refinement of the given bundle. And I'm not going to define it here. I will define it in a later lecture. But what I'm going to tell you here are the good things that it does. So we take for granted that it is possible to define such a thing. And here are the good properties of the Glaser refinement. First of all, the Glaser refinement of a bundle is a subbundle of the original bundle. However, every section of the original bundle is already a section of the possibly smaller bundle, H tilde. And furthermore, H tilde can be computed from H by doing linear algebra in fixed dimension and taking the limit. I emphasize the fixed dimension because if somehow we were taking, if we were doing elementary linear algebra in ever larger dimensions and taking the limit of the results of that, I would say that's not computable. But here we'll see that H tilde can be computed from H. So that's very good. That means if we want to know whether H has a section, it's enough to look at H tilde. H tilde is, maybe it's equal to H, maybe it's strictly smaller, but if we've discarded anything from H to arrive at H tilde, the stuff we've discarded is junk. It can never arise as the gen of a section. Okay, so if we want, here's what I said, if we want to know whether H has a section, we may replace it by its Glaser refinement, and we make progress by deleting irrelevant junk. Okay, we can keep going. Having Glaser refined H, we can then Glaser refine the Glaser refinement. And we can Glaser refine that, and we can keep going. And so by induction, we have a whole sequence of subbundles, starting with, let's say, H0, the given bundle H. And by induction, HL plus 1 is the Glaser refinement of HL. And so by induction, the bundle that we started with is H0. That contains H1 as a subbundle, which contains H2 as a subbundle, and so on. And H and HL have always the same sections, even though perhaps these HL are getting smaller and smaller. And furthermore, we can compute HL from H. Okay. Now the process stabilizes. At some point, and one can actually compute a value, not necessarily the best value. One can compute a value without star, at which the process stabilizes, and from that point on, are all the same. Okay, so further Blaser refinement is pointless because it just produces the same bundle over and over again. And so let's call that H star, and let's call that the state of Blaser refinement. Okay. And so the theorem is that H has a section if and only if H star has no empty fibers. So H star is something that can be computed from H, and so we look at it. If it has any empty fibers, of course it has no sections, therefore the original bundle has no sections. That's essentially trivial. But in the other direction, it's Caecilius' theorem, and the claim is that the only obstruction to H having a section is that the only obstruction is the possibility that H star has some empty fibers. Okay. Okay. Here's an application on the border between analysis and algebraic geometry. Let's see, running out of time. Maybe. Okay. Let's start with an example due to Malhoster. So we have a continuous function f of three variables x, y, and z. And we want to solve the equation on the slide where f, g, and h are unknown continuous functions. So this is only one equation for three unknowns, but we want our f, g, and h to be continuous. And that may or may not be possible. Let's make a simplifying assumption. Suppose that the right-hand side there, capital F, is C infinity. In that case, it's an exercise to show that the conditions on the slide are necessary and sufficient for the existence of a continuous solution. So I certainly don't have time to say anything about the proof, but it is true and not very hard. But I want to draw your attention to a strange fact. We are interested only in continuous solutions, F, G, and H, C0. But what we are asking about capital F involves derivatives of order up to 3. That's weird. Now suppose F is merely capital F, the right-hand side is merely continuous. How can we tell whether a solution exists? And now, of course, we can't apply the previous criteria because maybe capital F has no derivatives of order 3, but we'll see in a later lecture. In the full problem, or that was an example, the full problem which was stated for C0 by the algebraic geometers on the slide, Reiner, Epstein, Hoster, and Kolar. Here's the problem. We're given functions, Q's and capital F, and we solve the one equation, and we want the solution in Cn. And this can be solved. And so there are necessary and sufficient conditions for the existence of the solution. In the C0 case, there was a strange paper by Janosch and B containing two completely independent solutions. One by Janosch involving assuming that the data are polynomials and done using algebraic geometry that I wish I understood, and the other assuming that everything is really continuous involving elementary analysis, which I understand much better. Kevin and I saw how to treat the CN case, and the punchline is that the generalization of the idea of Blaser refinement. Which was introduced for Whitney problems, is exactly what you need in order to do this, this problem in real algebraic geometry. Okay, here's a theorem which generalizes what I said about the example. There are some differential operators analogous to the derivatives of order up to 3, and I think I don't have time to state the theorem, but we'll get back to it. But whatever that theorem was, in the example of Hoster, here are the differential operators, and you can recognize them as being the same as in the alleged, as in the exercise. Okay, I want to close by talking about selection problems. So remember the original work of Pavel on finiteness principles used selection problems. Now we're going to come back and talk about selection problems. I'm going to talk first about CM selection and then about Lipschitz selection. The CM selection is joint work with Arye and Kevin, and the work on Lipschitz selection is joint work with Pavel. Okay, so here's the CM selection problem. So we're going to fix M, N, and D greater than or equal to 1. We have a finite subset in Rn, as on the slide. But now, instead of having a function value, instead of having a real function value for each point x and e, instead we're given a convex target set k in Rd. And we want to find a selection of this collection of convex targets. A selection is what it says on the slide. It's a map from Rn to Rd whose value at each point x belongs to the target assigned to that point. So again, there on the slide is the definition of a selection. And we want a selection that belongs to Cm. Okay, is it clear? I hope it's clear because there's no time. Okay. And so the questions I'd like to ask are, how small can we take the Cm norm of a Cm selection? And can we compute a selection whose Cm norm is as small as possible, up to a factor capital C, which now depends only on little m, and d. Okay, here's a simple one-dimensional example. Suppose that, forget about this d, let's say we're just looking at real value functions. Suppose I want a C2 function such that at each point x in a set of dots on the x-axis there, the value of the function lies in the green interval sitting above above the blue dot. And so I've made an attempt to draw a reasonable selection of the family of green intervals. So that's a very simple one-dimensional example. But as you'll see, I don't really understand simple one-dimensional examples like that. Well, let's not be quite so pessimistic just yet. Here's a finiteness theorem. This is by Arye, Kevin, and me. So for a large enough integer constant k and real constant c determined by these m and d, the following holds. Suppose that for every k-point subset, k is that integer constant, the finiteness number, for every k-point subset s contained in e, there is a selection for the set of targets just at the points x and s, so for that little subproblem, with Cm norm at most 1. If that's true, oh my god, oh there's a, that is, oh my god, then there's a terrible misprint. The whole problem has a Cm selection with Cm norm not necessarily less than or equal to 1, less than or equal to the constant c. Oops. So this is the, having given credit to my co-authors and myself, I should say that Yuri and Pavel deserve great credit for having prepared the way. They introduced the whole idea of a selection problem, the idea of a finiteness theorem. They applied it to interpolation problems, and they've proven early results on the Lipschitz selection. Okay, now... So we have, anyway, a finiteness theorem, which is the beginning of a discussion of algorithms to compute things. And so the finiteness theorem raises the hope that there is an algorithm to exhibit C-optimal solutions of C-n selection problems using O of n log n one-time work, O of log n query work, O of n RAM, as in the discussion of interpolation problems. So we try to generalize that to the problem to selection problems. Well, it raises that hope, but so far we don't even know how to do simple 1D problems like the one I sketched with blue points, green intervals, and the red graph. We don't know how to do that. However, in joint work with Bernat, we can do approximate CM selection. And because I am running out of time, I'm just going to say that what happens is that given a selection problem and a bound that you would like for the CM norm, either the algorithm guarantees that you cannot solve it, or it guarantees and that you can solve it, produces a solution for a slightly easier problem in which you allow the convex sets to be dilated slightly around their centers of gravity, as in the picture. Okay, and I'm going to skip the precise statement. We will get to the precise statement in the very last lecture. Okay. So if that parameter tau were equal to zero, that would mean we could solve selection problems perfectly, and again, in very simple cases, I don't know how. Okay, now let me talk about Lipschitz selection. So, so far we've always been working in Rn, now we want to work in an arbitrary metric space. And now for each point x in the metric space, we are given a compact convex target set. And we want a Lipschitz map from the metric space x into Rd that takes values in the appropriate targets. And Lipschitz is the correct degree of smoothness because we don't have a differential structure, we have a linear metric space. So this is the problem. Okay, so Pavel and I have a finiteness theorem, which is stated on the slide. So suppose that you have a Lipschitz selection problem, and suppose that for every subproblem arising from a subset with at most 2 to the d points, then there exists a selection that works just for those points. Then there is a there exists a selection with Lipschitz constant at most c that takes values in the targets, and that's true for all x. And that c depends only on the dimension d in which the targets sit. 2 to the d is best possible, and you'll be hearing more about this from me in a future lecture and from Pavel tomorrow. I've skipped the fact that infinitely many special cases of that have already been proven by Pavel, and we build on that. Anyway, okay. Well, so that's again the beginning of the subject. Now that we have a finiteness principle, can we say anything useful about computing Lipschitz selections? I really don't know. I don't know anything about it. I say I haven't thought seriously about it, but it's a natural question. Okay. Well, that's almost the end. Maybe if time is correctly measured, it is the end. Let me just mention topics that I think deserve a great deal of discussion, but that I haven't talked about largely because I don't feel I know as much about them as about the ones I talked about. So first of all, it's very interesting to fit manifolds and not just graphs of functions to data, and you'll be hearing from Lati about that. Let's see. There are remarkable theorems about extensions with the least possible norm, not just up to a factor of c. Breuer and somebody named Wells many years ago found in the particular case of C11 a version of Whitney's classical extension theorem with absolutely optimal constants. I haven't mentioned anything about C infinity extensions, though, because I don't know anything about C infinity extensions. I haven't mentioned problems with constraints for non-negative functions, for functions mapping into the unit ball, for convex functions. You've been hearing about convex functions this afternoon. Okay. Again, many of the algorithms I talked about were theoretically optimal, but of no practical use because some damn constants are too big and you get to obtain practical algorithms. And some very recent work by Arnie, by Paulus Klartog, and by two grad students, Fry Pearson and Carruth, raised the possibility for the first time of maybe getting good constants. I don't have time to describe. And finally, there's a whole, when you talk about extending functions, there's a whole other half of the subject that I didn't mention so far, which is that if you have a function defined on an open set, then can you extend it into a reasonable function on all of Rn? You'll hear about that later from Martin Zobel. Okay, let's stop here. I think I've used up my time. Thank you.
Does anyone have any questions? Okay, so in that event, we now have a 30-minute break, and we resume activities at 10:30. There's coffee and snacks outside. And can I ask each of you to please sign your name at the sign-in sheet at the front of the room? And if you don't see your name there, please put your name as well as your email address so that you can receive announcements.